Good evening, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 26th day of October 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and we're wrapping up a month that still has the potential to be really full of fireworks. So far, though, what we've gotten mostly is insanity. A whole lot of insanity. And literally, folks, there's almost no other way to start this recap of the week's events off other than to say the insanity just keeps on pushing the outer limits. Wait a minute. What does that mean anymore? So let's start off the recap with a look back at what now passes for a Just Us system in the Union of Soviet Socialist States of America, from a place that might even surprise you. A jury in Dallas, Texas, has decided that a 7-year-old boy, and now we have to be careful about using that term, will be restricted from further seeing his loving biological father and instead be placed in the sole custody of Dr. Ann Gorgulis, the father's ex-wife, to whom the young child isn't even biologically related, who's planning to forcibly chemically castrate the boy, turning him into a girl, using puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. In a shocking 11-1 decision, says Natural News' summary, Texas jurors decided that Jeffrey Younger, the father of 7-year-old James, will not be granted his request for sole managing conservatorship over both James and his twin brother, Jude. Dr. Gorgulis had been forcing young James to live as a so-called transgender female, even against his will, which James's father, Jeffrey, had tried to protect him from by seeking a legal remedy to have the boy permanently removed from her custody. But instead of recognizing that James is being abused by his so-called mother and siding with the boy's biological father, the Texas jury decided the boy should not only be able to be forced into being transgendered and that the father would lose custody of his two sons, but the man is also reportedly being forced by the jury to attend tolerance classes, a.k.a. a re-education camp for the LGBTQ Brave New World Order, with the goal of helping him to understand that the Bible is just plain wrong and that transgenderism is normal. Which, note some of the coverage, could be grounds for appeal, since the jury's ruling clearly violates Jeffrey's God-given, once constitutionally protected right to freedom of religion. And finally, as Ethan Huff observes for National News, the fact that we've come to expect this kind of insane, tyrannical, anti-family behavior in places like New York and the People's Republic of California doesn't mean we're not shocked to see it happening in Texas, of all places, and supposedly conservative-leaning Dallas to boot, which says a whole lot about how far this country has fallen into the grip of the LGBTQ perversion and open destruction of innocent children's lives, all in the name of so-called tolerance. And your host here, folks, has to add, I also think this speaks volumes about what's happened to the concept of what was once called trial by jury, but is now simply a jury-rigged jury trial, where the process of jury selection consists mostly of weeding out people with half a brain. And when you add to that the fact that the father, Jeffrey, is now no longer even allowed to call his own son James by his legal birth name, nor is he even allowed to call him a him, and it certainly speaks volumes about where we're headed. Your host likes to call it the intentional, planned hell on earth, and of course, what that means about what lies dead ahead. And on that score, yeah, there's more. Pocahontas, the lying Indian woman who turns out not to be Elizabeth Warren, but she does want to be the next dictator, now demands special protection for, drumroll please, transgendered migrants wanting to enter the United States and suck at the public teat. Are you kidding? I can hear people thinking and rolling their eyes. No, folks, this sadly is what passes for political discourse in Civil War II era America. In an 8-page letter to Trump administration officials, says the summary from the Gateway Pundit via Town Hall, Senator Sick, Elizabeth Warren, and Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin are demanding swift action to protect transgender migrants attempting to enter the United States, illegally or not, doesn't seem to matter anymore. The senators implore the administration to reverse immigration policies they consider harmful to transgenders and other so-called vulnerable populations. The policies they want reversed? Well, all of them. And the populations that are vulnerable? Well, all of them, except, of course, white, male, straight, cisgendered, and therefore politically incorrect, and let's not forget, people that can read the Bible instead of any other text that they consider sacred. Quote, we write to express alarm, how about hysteria, over reports detailing the abuse and neglect of transgender migrants and asylum seekers at the border and in U.S. custody, said the letter, and we ask you to immediately reverse policies that harm these vulnerable individuals and take swift action to blah-de-blah-de-blah. Writes one wag, and I can't help but kind of think there's more sanity in this one than the 8-page letter. This feels a bit like being on the Titanic as it's going down and somebody complaining that the croutons in the salad aren't gluten-free. Can't they find something else to whine about? Related story in the crazy world of Bolshevik Revolution 2.0. Biological male dominates at women's Masters Track Cycling World Championships, crushes competition, wins gold medal. Writes Christina Layla for the Gateway Pundit, transgender cyclist Rachel McKinnon, a biological male, dominated at the Masters Track Cycling World Championships in Manchester over the weekend, setting a women's sick world record on Saturday for the 35-39 sprint, won a 200-meter gold medal, and then complained about how unfair it would be if she, he, it was excluded from competing against real females. You know, the ones that don't have quite so much testosterone but do have biological parts he doesn't because God made them that way. All of which, folks, leads me to speculate about the most brilliant political strategy that I think the president could ever come up with, although I think maybe I've suggested it before. It would at least reveal, as if we didn't already know, the idiocy, the insanity, and the hypocrisy of these nutcases on the far left. What President Trump needs to do is announce that, well, today at least, he feels a little bit transgendered, and therefore he's claiming the title of the first not only female, but transgendered president in American history. And therefore all the leftists that want him out of the Oval Office need to just bow out and leave him alone. And you know what we'd hear, don't you? Oh no, that kind of thing applies to leftists only, whether it's the law, the right to keep and bear arms, real religious freedom, or the right to declare yourself whatever gender you feel like today, you have to be far left in order for that to apply. Case in point, next story from the Insanity and Hypocrisy Files, Dennis Quaid, age 65, has confirmed his engagement to a beautiful young lady, Laura Savoy, age 26. The trouble is, as Chris Minahan at Information Liberation points out, Quaid's engaged to a woman. So, and here I'll quote, if 65-year-old Dennis Quaid was marrying instead a 26-year-old man, the media and the Twitterati would be celebrating, tweeting, hashtag love is love, and attacking any and all of the intolerant bigots who would dare frown upon their relationship. And your ever-increasingly cynical host would go one step further and add the following, too. If Dennis Quaid was instead marrying or just loving on a 12-year-old he, she, or it, not only would the media and Hollywood be silent, but he'd probably have FBI protection and just possibly a guaranteed seat in the California legislature. And you already knew there'd be more insanity, and we're really just getting started, on the impeach front, too, didn't you? Where we don't need no stinking evidence has been superseded by we don't need no stinking rule of law, we don't need no stinking due process, and we certainly don't need any stinking transparency either. Yeah, there are plenty of stories on that front today, including from the same sources. Speaker for the traitors, nutcase Nancy Pelosi, and the lawless Democrats, including the shiftless one, are running their historic scam on the American people. No, there hasn't been a vote, and the entire proceeding is being held completely in secret in a secluded room away from public viewing, away from cameras, and for the most part, away from even Republicans who aren't allowed any consideration in the entire process. They're not allowed to call any witnesses. And the dumbed-down public isn't even allowed to know who their so-called whistleblower witness, officially, really is. Oh, and members of Congress not on the impeach team weren't allowed to read the transcripts either. But of course, as the week progressed, there were all kinds of developments on this insane front. On Wednesday, though, we saw there were at least a few actual Republicans who know what that word means that still have a bit of a backbone in the House and Senate. Here's a piece from Christina Layla, late in the morning, via the Gateway Pundit, about how GOP lawmakers stormed the secure Achtung impeachment chamber and then staged their own sit-in. Republican lawmakers on Wednesday, it says, barged into the secret impeachment chamber, defended the president, and shouted at the lawless Democrats. Members of the House Freedom Caucus, including Representative Biggs, Meadows, Gohmert, Jordan, and Gates, led the way. The House Democrats had brought in Pentagon official Laura Cooper for another secret star chamber hearing. The Republicans weren't having it. And they stormed the SCIF, or Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, whereupon they staged a sit-in and ordered pizza. Representatives Scalise and Jordan even then offered some to the press. The oh-so-self-impressed reporters pointed out that they couldn't accept gifts, to which Scalise responded, "This is no quid pro quo. You can eat it." And here's the final irony, folks. According to Representative Mark Warner, the leader of the coup, Shifty Adam Schiffless, is now threatening ethics punishment violations against the Republican lawmakers who dared to call them out on this impeachment sham. Representative John Ratcliffe of Texas told Fox News Tuesday that not a single Democrat Trump-hating witness has provided actual testimony that the Ukrainians were even aware that military aid was allegedly being withheld from them by President Trump. And as Ratcliffe said, you can't have a quid pro quo without a quo. But one thing's for sure now, you certainly can have an impeachment without evidence. And given what's being done to the rule of law right before our eyes, it looks like we can have a civil war, too. That's what their intent certainly is. The president called out the impeachment inquiry for what it is. Not just a coup, he's used that word repeatedly, but a lynching now. And the stuck pig squealed to high heaven. Here's the headline from the Daily Mail in this case. "What the hell is wrong with you?" said a black lawmaker in fury after Donald Trump dared to call their impeachment sham a lynching. Let's start then with what the president actually tweeted. "So someday," wrote the president, "if a Democrat becomes president and the Republicans win the House, even by a tiny margin, they can impeach the president without due process or fairness or any legal rights." Well, wait a second, or unquote. That's assuming, of course, they even bother with the sham of elections. Back then to the quote. "Although Republicans," said the president, "must remember what they're witnessing here, a lynching," unquote. Well, says the rest of the story, how dare the president apply their term to himself? After all, everybody knows, seems to be the point here, that only black people can actually be lynched. Said the Daily Mail, "It's highly unusual for white politicians to invoke lynchings, the mob murder phenomenon which took the lives of 3,446 African Americans in the U.S. between 1882 and 1968. Oops, that is, up until video surfaced of Joe Biden calling the impeachment of William Jefferson the rapist Clinton a lynching back in 1998. Uh-oh, on to the next story. Most of the week, the question was, will the FISA report from the Office of the Inspector General that people have been waiting for, those that are outside the press anyway in the waste stream, for oh so long, ever be made public? Or will the impeach, impeach, impeach mantra just keep getting louder and louder so that nothing else ever really matters and the rule of law disappears without so much as a whimper? Well, on Friday morning, this came out from the Gateway Pundit's Joe Hoft, who said, "Get your popcorn ready. No less than four different reports have been released recently, indicating the days ahead will be devastating to the deep state." Well, we'll hopefully live to see that. But anyway, Thursday night, he said, was historic. The news coming out on four fronts indicates the deep state should be very worried. That means the impeach rhetoric, of course, will accelerate. Those of us uncovering the many corrupt actions taken by the Obama deep state have been looking forward to this day for some time. Question is, if there was a tree fall in the forest and the WAPO doesn't report it, was there sound, right? Well, number one on his list, though, is the FISA report. The DOJ's long-awaited document is about to be released. Fox News is reporting that the Just Us Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz has told House and Senate lawmakers on Thursday that the process of finalizing his report into potential FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, you can just say unconstitutional rape of the Fourth Amendment if you prefer, abuses, and who could have imagined there'd be abuses of something so unconstitutional, ahead of the 2016 presidential election was, quote, nearing completion. Hey, there's something we haven't heard before. This according to a letter obtained by Fox News. And the lengthy, their word, draft report quote, concerns sensitive national security and law enforcement matters, said Horowitz in the letter, adding that he anticipated the final report will be released publicly, no, he didn't say when, with few redactions, and he didn't anticipate the need to prepare a separate classified version from the stuff that the public may eventually live to see. Now, there is at least one excuse buried in here. While some people have suggested, including your host, that the deep state was deep-sixing the FISA report, some members of Congress, like Jim Jordan, if I remember correctly, have said similarly. But another theory is the IG may have been held back from releasing his report until a time when it wouldn't impede the Attorney General's investigation by his DA, John Durham, into various criminal actions, and yes, we'll get to that in a second, before and after the 2016 election. Reason being, had the IG released a document before all the players in Durham's investigation were at least initially questioned, they might have, who could have thought this would be the case, altered their testimonies based on what they know might be obvious perjury right off the top. Item number two, Attorney General Barr and John Durham's investigation into deep state crimes has also been kicked up a notch. The story is that the John Durham investigation has now been officially turned into a criminal investigation, and even the far-left New York Times is admitting that just us department officials have shifted their administrative review of the Russia investigation overseen by the Attorney General into a criminal inquiry, according to people familiar with the matter, giving the prosecutor, John Durham, more latitude, including the power to subpoena for witness testimony and documents, to convene a grand jury, and to file, have you been waiting for this, actual criminal charges. Only thing the Times doesn't tell us, notes the Gateway pundit, is just how long Durham has actually been running his now admittedly criminal investigation. Item number three, Sidney Powell's filing regarding General Flynn's case. We found out that Sidney Powell is aware of a number of documents and actions by the Obama deep state that have been withheld from the general and that are damning to the government's case. Hey, there's something we've never seen before, right? So damning that the attorney, Powell, is now asking the court to dismiss the case against General Flynn. Among other things, we learned that the criminally evil former attorney for the FBI, Lisa Page, altered a 302 document materially in a manner that implicated General Flynn for lying to the FBI, when in fact it was the FBI's own so-called people that were lying through their teeth. Then she lied about making the edits, too. You know, all of that would be a crime if anybody else tried to do it. We also learned from the same source that Obama's former Director of National Intelligence, SIC, James Clapper, was involved in the felony release of General Flynn's phone call with a Russian diplomat before the 2017 inauguration. Item number four on his list involves additional reports about just how crooked the Obama vice president, you know the name, creepy Joe Biden, was in all of his pay-for-play scandals. It's a revelation, says J.D. Hayes for Natural News, though, that adds more to the mountain of evidence that exists already proving the Obama regime was the nation's most corrupt ever. This in a report out Thursday showing that the previous administration was in fact alerted to concerns about Hunter Biden's crooked business dealings in Ukraine, but guess what, folks? Yeah, they were summarily ignored. And surprisingly enough, it was even reported by the WAPO, which said, quote, a career State Department official overseeing Ukraine policy told congressional investigators this week, not to be confused with the Star Chamber, of course, that he'd raised concerns in early 2015 about then-Vice President Joe Biden's son serving, that's a rough term, isn't it? How about sucking at the teat of the board of a Ukrainian energy company, but was turned away by a Biden staffer, according to three people familiar with the testimony. And that official, it continues, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, testified earlier this week before a closed congressional hearing that he was worried that Hunter Biden's position as a board member at Burisma Holdings, an energy firm already under investigation for corruption, would, quote, complicate efforts by U.S. diplomats to convey to Ukrainian officials the importance of avoiding conflicts of interest, unquote, and good grief, said the Post. What we now should understand clearly, folks, is that there's a big difference, in fact, a left-right chasm, between actually avoiding conflicts of interest and avoiding media coverage, or even allowing records of them, to exist. which goes a whole long way to explaining why it was so necessary for all of Hitler's private email servers, disk drives, and other records to simply disappear, not only physically, but from the front pages as well. Thank you, Comey, Mueller, et al. And it certainly goes a long way as well to explaining why it is so necessary for this same deep state crowd to cover up what they did then and impeach that guy who was never supposed to get elected anyway before he can actually expose to the American people the depths of the corruption that they will literally kill. And that means, obviously, not only people and institutions, but an entire nation as well, rather than allow to be exposed. This next story sheds some light there, and it also points out that the destruction of the rule of law isn't limited to the United States. From Craig Murray, a longtime friend of Julian Assange via his blog, and of course Zero Hedge, "I was deeply shaken," the author writes, "while witnessing yesterday's events in Westminster Magistrates Court." And he's of course talking about the UK, where he says every decision was railroaded through over the scarcely heard objections and arguments of Assange's legal team by a magistrate who barely even pretended to be listening. But before I get on to the blatant lack of what they call fair process, he says, "the first thing I have to note is Julian's condition. I was badly shocked by just how much weight my friend has lost, by the speed at which his hair has receded, and by the appearance of premature and vastly accelerated aging. He has a pronounced limp that I've never seen before, and since his arrest, he's lost over 15 kilograms, or over 30 pounds. Furthermore, he said his physical appearance wasn't quite as shocking as his mental deterioration. When he was asked to give both his name and date of birth, he struggled visibly over a period of several seconds to recall both of them. And until yesterday," he added, "I'd always been quietly skeptical of those who claimed that Julian's treatment amounted to torture. Even Niels Meltzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, who suggested he may be subject to debilitating drug treatments. But having attended the trials in Uzbekistan of several victims of extreme torture, and having worked with survivors from Sierra Leone and elsewhere, I can tell you that yesterday changed my mind entirely. And Julian exhibited exactly the same symptoms of a torture victim being brought blinking into the light, particularly," he said, "in terms of disorientation, confusion, and the real struggle to assert free will through the fog of learned helplessness." And maybe that, folks, is a metaphor for what's going on around the world when it comes to the destruction of the rule of law. Says the author, "though I'd even been more skeptical of those who claimed, as a senior member of his legal team did to me on Sunday night, that they're now worried Julian might not even survive to the end of the extradition process." And he says, "I find myself now not only believing it, but haunted by the thought. To see my friend, the most articulate man, the fastest thinker I have ever known, reduced to that shambling and incoherent wreck was unbearable." And here, folks, your host can't help but add, perhaps that is the message this sham trial is intended to send to the rest of the world that might try to stand up against what they're doing to the concept of a free press. Yet the agents of the state, particularly, he says, the callous magistrate Vanessa Bereister, were not just prepared but eager to be a part of this blood sport. And she actually told Julian that if he were incapable of following the proceedings, well, his lawyers could explain to him what happened to him later. And the very fact that an intelligent and competent man had been reduced to the state of somebody now incapable of even following court proceedings didn't give her a millisecond of concern. Craig Murray then proceeds to spend several pages describing the sham charges. Nothing to do with Sweden, nothing to do with sex, nothing to do with the 2016 election, and in fact, not much to do with anything. Because as the farce unfolded, it became clear, says Murray, why we were forced to sit through it. The U.S. government was dictating its instructions to Lewis, the so-called prosecutor, who was relaying those instructions to Bereister, who was ruling them as if they were her legal decision. The charade would have been no less transparent if they'd simply gotten rid of the judge and had the U.S. representatives bang the gavel. Bottom line, the extradition is plainly being rushed through in accordance with a Washington-dictated timetable. And, concludes Murray, "the whole experience was profoundly upsetting because it was very clear there was no genuine process of legal consideration, because what we were sitting through was a naked demonstration of the power of the state and a naked dictation of proceedings by the Americans. Julian was put in a box behind bulletproof glass, and I and the 30 other odd members of the public who had squeezed in were in a different box behind more bulletproof glass. I don't even know if he could see me or his other friends in the court, or if he was even capable of recognizing anybody. He certainly gave no indication that he did. He goes on to describe the inhuman regime Julian is subjected to, used on major terrorists, and how it's now being imposed on a publisher who is a remand prisoner. Says Murray, I've been both cataloging and protesting for years the increasingly authoritarian powers of the UK state, but that the most gross abuse could be so open and undisguised is still a shock. This campaign of demonization and dehumanization against Julian, based on government and media lie after government and media lie, has now led to a situation where he can slowly be killed right in plain public view and arraigned on a charge of publishing the truth about government wrongdoing, basically, while society ignores what's going on. And bottom line, unless Julian is released shortly, he will no doubt be destroyed. And if the state can do this, well then, who is next? As if we didn't know. And we'll be right back.
Did you write the book of love? And do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so.
I can be since I found serenity. But you can't take the sky from me.
Welcome back again now to the second segment for this evening. This is your host, Mark Hall. And given that we spent so much time in the first segment talking about insanity and how that's resulting in the complete destruction of what was once called the rule of law, let's change direction about 90 degrees at this point and talk about another one of those uncomfortable topics for a lot of people, especially when they realize they've been lied to about it for so long. And whether it's what's good for you, or how you came to be, and how you might want to continue to be, the Bible really turns out to have been right when it said, there comes a time, and I think that time is now, when we realize we have inherited lies from our fathers. So, here next, a story that your Bible student host admits I find not only interesting, but downright timely, considering what all's going on in the world. And I'll suggest as well that the headline doesn't quite go the place your host would. But the article by Vanessa Chalmers for the Daily Mail Online is headlined thusly, Scientists admit they have no idea how a newly discovered virus infects host cells after they found the strain while combing through, where else folks, pig feces. And some people still wonder why Scripture says they're not food. And all right, it begins, scientists admit they have no idea how this newly found enterovirus infects other cells, because normally a virus replicates itself by attaching to a host cell using tiny spikes on its shell, resulting in illnesses such as the flu. But researchers in Japan say the virus, which was found, as I mentioned, while coming through pig feces, doesn't have a spiky outer shell. The experts at the Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology are therefore baffled by how the virus is able to attack cells. The professor who led the research, Tetsuya Mitsutani, said, quote, we may be facing an entirely new system of viral evolution, unquote. And here's where I'll take my first pause, folks, and suggest, you know, it's just possible this wasn't an evolved virus at all, because there are a whole lot of bioweapons engineers who no doubt realize if you really want a nasty virus that will infect humans and jump that species barrier, start with things based on pigs. So yeah, I'm not afraid to suggest this certainly has the smell of something that was engineered rather than evolved. But that doesn't mean the rest of the article doesn't shed a bit more light on the subject. After the point about how viruses replicate by attaching to a host cell with those tiny spikes on their shell, they note that viruses are simple, non-living creatures made of genetic material primarily called RNA and DNA. The spiky coat, called a capsid, is made of protein and comes in various structures depending upon the kind of viruses. And these so-called enteroviruses cause a number of illnesses, from rashes in small children to colds, encephalitis, and even diarrhea. Pig farms, of course, and those who can read scripture know this, are filthy environments home to scores of viruses which evolve rapidly, making them ideal for scientific research. And of course, although the Bible doesn't say precisely why, making pigs not suitable as food for humans. They are the scavengers of the land, primarily designed to eat dead things. Other enteroviruses from the G family, or EV-G, are of course found in pig feces, but the newly discovered type is a novel, defective variant. It's called type 2 EV-G, and it can't possibly invade a host cell on its own because it doesn't have the same structures as other strains, which causes Mitsutani and his colleagues to believe this new strain is being aided by a so-called helper virus. But they haven't yet figured out how that works. Maybe they could talk to some of the guys in the bioweapons lab. But they did say, the recombinant virus we found has no structural proteins, meaning the recombinant virus cannot make a viral particle. We're wondering how this new virus came to be, how it infects cells, or how it develops a viral particle. And he said that their future work will be involved with solving this mystery of viral evolution. What do you bet there aren't some Big Brother incentives for figuring that out? So I'll say it again, folks. In this environment, it's really helpful to be paying attention to the kind of things that are being telegraphed to us, whether they come as warnings or tidbits from science. We got similar warnings this week from the field of economics, or in this case, unconstitutional currency being passed off as money, the almighty fiat dollar, which is getting pretty long in the tooth. This from Zero Hedge, which said on Thursday that the Fed had injected another $134 billion in liquidity as the short-term repo is oversubscribed, again, amidst a month-end liquidity panic. Yeah, let's go into some more detail on that. With stocks threatening to close in the red late Wednesday, the Fed sparked a furious last-hour rally by proclaiming in a statement published at 3:15 Eastern Time, precisely when the S&P ramp began, the New York Fed confirmed it would begin to dramatically increase both its overnight and term liquidity provisions beginning tomorrow, that would be Thursday, through November the 14th. And as Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge point out, that was a massive 60% increase in the overnight repo liquidity availability from $75 billion to $120 billion, and a full 28% jump in the term repo provision. It's just more evidence the Fed will not back off, said Wells Fargo rate strategist Mike Schumacher, as the year-end gets closer. The Fed wants to take out more insurance. You had repo pickup last week, and that might not have gone over too well. Needless to say, says Zero Hedge, if the funding shortage was actually getting any better, none of this would be happening. Instead, it appears that with every passing day, the liquidity shortage is getting worse, even as the Fed's balance sheet is surging. The only possible explanation, just about everybody that's paying attention concludes, is that somebody big, really needed to lock in cash before the month end. The maturity of the op is on November 7th, which is when a no-deal Brexit may go live, and of course, there are other things on the horizon, too, like a no-deal constitution and an impeachment for any reason but at any cost in the United States. Not to mention the biggest debt bubble in history, and we could go on and on, but you get the point. But anyway you slice it, the question remains, just why and what is the source of this unexpected spike in liquidity needs for a system which already has $1.5 trillion in excess reserves? And they suggest, while some of us await the answer, you can probably expect stocks to close pleasantly in the green, well, at least for now and up until the you-know-what hits the fan, as all of these dealers transform their newly granted liquidity into bets on risk assets. I guess, folks, if the money's free and you got lots of it and there's more to come, you might as well put it all on Red 7 and spin that wheel. And there, too, is another continuing metaphor for our times. For quite a while now, it's been good to be too big to fail, and it's even better to be too big to jail. I saw a piece late this week by Robert Gore at the Straight Line Logic blog, also courtesy of Zero Hedge, which aggregates a whole lot of good stuff like this, entitled, The Holy Grail for Our Rulers. And here his thoughts really resonate with something our host has been talking about now for quite some time, making the truth irrelevant. He suggests that the deep state and their swamp critter puppets finally believe they have their holy grail in sight. And to make the point, he quotes Ayn Rand in her second most famous novel, The Fountainhead, where character Ellsworth Tui talks to Peter Keating and says, "But there's always a purpose in nonsense. Don't bother to examine a folly. Ask yourself only what it accomplishes." And she really nailed it some three-quarters of a century ago. So, begins Gore, just what do the follies of Russiagate and then the Ukraine impeachment controversy actually accomplish? Begin by understanding that truth is always the enemy of power. Exposure of power's motivations, depredations, and corruption never serves the ends of power, so truth is often suppressed, and those who disclose it, of course, are persecuted. Any illegitimate government, currently that means all of them, that fails to do so, literally risks their own termination. So what if, instead of suppressing the truth, a regime could simply render it irrelevant and not have to worry about it? That prospect really is the holy grail for those who rule or seek to rule, especially the whole world. And basically, he says, what they're saying is this. We rule you in every aspect of your life. Your wishes, desires, and plans are immaterial to us. By the way, so are your votes. You will do as we tell you, or you will be severely punished or eliminated. Our sole end is power. And we will be its corrupt and criminal beneficiaries. You are our slaves. Unquote. And imagine, continues Gore, if that announcement wasn't met with outrage or resistance, but only quiet acceptance, even approval. And by the way, take a look at the news today, and for the most part, you'll see we're already there. The regime, says the author, has actually disclosed the horrifying truth about itself, and nobody protests or even cares. It's rendered the truth irrelevant, so what future disclosure could possibly threaten it in any way? Look at what happened to Jeffrey Epstein, for crying out loud. That, he says, is the real purpose of Russiagate, and now Ukraine and the so-called impeachment controversy, they're part of a long-running plan to simply render the truth about any rulers, that they don't pick anyway, irrelevant. The project is that well advanced, and contrary to the Ayn Rand admission by Tui, let's examine these follies to understand what's happening and what they've managed to accomplish. The key assertion upon which Russiagate rested was that the DNC computer server was attacked by a Russian operative named Guccifer 2.0, who then turned that data obtained over to WikiLeaks, which WikiLeaks has said was a great big whopper all along, because they indicated that basically the fix was in and Bernie didn't have a chance against Hitlery. WikiLeaks, though, for their part, released those damning emails just 3 days before the Democratic Convention back in 2016. Now, he spends a lot of time next talking about something your host has already explored in some detail. Bottom line, the Guccifer story was a complete whitewash, a lie. And it involves another conspiratorial accomplice, CrowdStrike, which claimed it had found malware on the server, but you can't see it, and neither can the FBI, even though at this point they pretty much owned the FBI too. And to make matters even stinkier, it's just possible that the server actually ended up in, say it with me folks, the Ukraine. The damning truth, though, was, quite some time ago, revealed by VIPS, an impeccably credentialed private intelligence service called the Veteran Intelligence Agents for Sanity, all of whose members are former intelligence community professionals, including former head of the NSA's technical division, William Benny. VIPS analyzed the metadata on their own and proved conclusively that it could not possibly have been hacked by the Russians or anybody else remotely. It took an insider who actually put a thumb drive into the server itself and downloaded the data at very high speed directly onto a piece of physical media that was then removed from the premises. And that was even before the servers were removed from the premises, too. Speculation, of course, suggests that the guy who done the deal was Seth Rich, but as you probably know, the late DNC staffer isn't talking to anybody anymore. Which takes us right to the crux of the matter. With this one fact, the entire Russia, Russia, Russia narrative should have collapsed. It ultimately did collapse, of course, with the release of the Mueller witch hunt report and his embarrassing testimony before Congress, all of which was a failure by Trump's many enemies. But from the standpoint of their ultimate mission, rendering the truth irrelevant, it's been a shining success. And if that sounds a bit surprising, keep listening. The promoters kept their bogus narrative balloon afloat for 2 full years after it was decisively punctured, and they endlessly harassed Trump to boot. Not only that, but even after the Mueller fiasco and the admissions that the story was totally groundless, Almost half of the populace still believes it anyway, and the mainstream media continues to circulate it as if it was true, in spite of all the evidence, which is why the Democrats now feel they can get away with their attempt to impeach the president over a phone call that he had with the Ukraine president, Volodymyr Zelensky, in spite of the fact that what he was doing was absolutely consistent with policy that we used to have back when we were a constitutional republic, i.e., if there's criminality, and you've even got a disclosure treaty with the nation in which the criminal acts were accomplished, it's actually okay to ask for the evidence. And obviously, and here's part of the point, we've reached the place where the evidence is immaterial. Says Robert Gore, ostensibly Ukraine is a minefield for Democrats. In 2014, the U.S. sponsored a coup against the Ukraine's duly elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, which obviously hasn't worked out well for the U.S. He goes into some detail on that score. The puppet Ukraine government has been a corrupt money pit for Western aid, loans, and loan guarantees, featuring, among many questionable characters, a coterie that reveres Nazi Germany and the role it played in World War II. And they seem to want to do the same thing again here in the Fourth Reich. The Ukrainian government is a loser, he says, but it's our loser, and Trump has doubled down on Obama's failure, backing monetary aid and weapon shipments to the beleaguered nation. And here follows more of the truth that you're not allowed to hear. Russiagate was launched by Ukrainian officials who disseminated rumors in 2016 that Trump was in league with Russia and later openly questioned his suitability for the presidency. The DNC dispatched a contractor named Alexandra Chalupa to Ukraine to search for compromising material on the campaign, especially Paul Manafort, then the Trump campaign chairman. And in other words, the Democrats sought information from a foreign power to influence the 2016 election, precisely what they're now accusing their enemy of doing. CrowdStrike, the firm that investigated the server the DNC wouldn't let either the FBI or NSA touch, was founded by Ukrainian Dmitry Alpervovich, a senior fellow with the anti-Russian Atlantic Council think tank, funded by a fanatically anti-Russian oligarch, Viktor Pinchuk, who donated at least $25 million to guess who? Yeah, the Clinton Foundation before the 2016 election. And CrowdStrike, it turns out, never even produced their final report on the Russia hacking investigation and had to revise and retract statements it used to support its bogus conclusions. And yeah, all of that involves some supposed Russian fingerprints that CrowdStrike claimed they found, but they could have been put there by the CIA, and since nobody's going to be allowed to check their results anyway, who knows? In his phone call with President Zelensky, President Trump elliptically mentioned CrowdStrike, and that, folks, your host suggests, as do anybody else who's looked at the information, is where the alarm bells really started going off in Deep State HQ. Because it looks like he was on the trail of asking to have CrowdStrike itself investigated, saying, quote, I'd like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. He then implied that Ukraine might even have the DNC server. Quote, the server, they say Ukraine has it. And it was in this context that he first mentioned having Ukrainian officials work with Rudy Giuliani and the Attorney General William Barr, and only later did the topic of the criminal Biden family come up. And in this case, Trump said, quote, the other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that, so that whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging, and this is absolutely true, folks. We've played the recordings here that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me, unquote. And yeah, maybe it's obvious by now, Joe Biden actually did what the far left now accuses their enemy, President Trump, of doing. It's the old big lie playbook right out of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Evidently, Bill Ayers, too, accuse your enemies of what you yourself have been up to. And yeah, they claim he interfered in Ukraine's investigative and judicial processes for political benefit. It's disgusting. It's right smack in your face. And as Robert Gore points out, it's the holy grail for deep state rulers. The known indisputable facts, says the author here, make a clear prima facie case of influence peddling and bribery. And had the Ukraine prosecutor general Viktor Shokin, who Biden brags he managed to get fired, been allowed to pursue his investigation, he might well have launched criminal proceedings against Burisma and perhaps Joe's son, Hunter Biden. that Daddy managed to get that cushy paycheck for, in spite of the fact that he knew nothing about the business and never actually bothered to do anything to earn that money anyway. Well, other than perhaps the obvious. And I've mentioned this point, but Robert Gore repeats it here. Back in the year 2000, the U.S. Senate ratified a treaty negotiated by the rapist President Bill Clinton's regime between the U.S. and the Ukraine. It was called Mutual Legal Assistance in Criminal Matters, providing, in the very words of Bill Clinton himself, quote, for a broad range of cooperation in criminal matters, which literally gives President Trump, charged with executing the law, all the authority he needed to ask the new president of Ukraine for assistance in investigating a prima facie case of influence peddling, bribery, and Biden's pressure on then-president of Ukraine to fire their prosecutor general. That Joe Biden is Trump's political rival is absolutely irrelevant. Unless we've already reached the point where, kind of like Hitler, come to think of it, anyone, if they're far enough left, who announces they're running for president automatically becomes immune from prosecution for any crimes, up to and including bribery, murder, and treason. So let's be real here. As the author says, one can hardly imagine a more inauspicious set of circumstances for the Democrats to launch an impeachment investigation and potentially a vote by the Democrat majority House of Representatives to impeach, followed by a Senate impeachment trial, than what we're now seeing. So why, oh why, are they doing it? Because they can, and because they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And a key part of all of the analysis that follows has to do with the fact that the rules for impeachment no longer matter. Once upon a time, there were precedents in the House for how these things were supposed to be done. No more. Process and rules don't matter any more now than the Constitution did. And now it's equally clear that the facts don't matter, and the truth is literally, utterly irrelevant. The author, of course, goes on to describe any number of reasonable possibilities. What if there is an impeachment? What if the Senate does or doesn't vote to convict? Others have pointed out, including actually Nancy Pelosi, that if this ruse doesn't work, they got plenty more on tap. They're openly talking about a palace coup, arresting the president, maybe the vice president too, and most of the cabinet while they're at it. And, of course, any number of scumbag politicians and washed-up Hollywood leftists have come right out and said, we ought to kill the guy. All of us that have been paying attention, of course, realize what the deep state realizes. For the coup really to succeed, they got to get rid of Mike Pence as well and make sure that Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi takes the reins, and then maybe she can nominate anybody she wants to be vice president, up to and including even the infamous Hitlery, for crying out loud, as has been suggested. Kind of lending a whole new meaning to the old phrase, by hook or by crook. All right, well, all of this begins to sound a lot like a conspiracy theory. This time around, though, there's another big difference. By now, it's more than obvious, since the truth doesn't matter, the rule of law doesn't matter, the Constitution hasn't mattered for years, and the far left isn't even trying to pretend anymore that the ends don't justify the means, and one thing that's obviously coming to an end is the Republic. I mean, for crying out loud, even the president can't seem to keep straight what form of government we were supposed to have had, which kind of makes it harder for him to argue now that it's being taken away. But in any case, folks, the real bottom line here is that we are absolutely positively standing on the cusp, and things are changing dramatically and very, very rapidly. Which brings me to the end of the piece by Robert Gore and his conclusion. Certainly worth paying attention to. It says the important point here is that voters constructively channel their frustration at what they saw happening to the Republic a few years ago into the election of Donald Trump. Thankfully, we still had an electoral college then, too. But when all of these kangaroo proceedings eventually play out the way that the left certainly intends them to, his supporters will have to deal with three relevant, and your host would say undeniable, truths. One, the government and those who pull its strings and its sycophants and toadies in the media business, academia, Hollywood, and elsewhere are utterly, completely corrupt. Number two, voting is absolutely useless except as a pacifier because A, the only choices allowed are those that are approved by the powers, and B, even if somebody makes it a little ways up the chain that isn't, or they change their minds later, you can see what happens to them. Which means, three, the system will never, ever be allowed to be reformed from the inside. And what all of that means, suggests Robert Gore, is that some of those who resist, and no, we're not talking about the Trump resistance, we're talking about the real ones, will be disillusioned and give up. The rest, though, will continue to resist, but they will decide it's not worth playing by the rules anymore. And here, folks, the article ends, and your host will take a slightly different tack. It's not about playing by the rules. It's recognizing that the rules were written by the same criminals, and that the real rules are the ones that were handed down to us by the creator of the universe. Things like thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not steal, which basically define a government anymore. So instead, I'd put it this way. We need to return to the real rules, the ones that were written for us by the creator of the universe, Yahuwah, and the example of how to follow those rules that was set down by the founding fathers when it comes time to withdraw consent from a corrupt government and institute new government in its place, because they knew that the real truths were and still are self-evident. Our creator gave us certain rights and responsibilities, and among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property, which is anathema to a socialist, communist, fascist world government state. And finally, that when any government becomes abusive of these ends, it is not only the right but the obligation of the people to alter or abolish it. In this case, though, we're talking about trying to restore what's been lost or deliberately destroyed. Your host will suggest, however, that there's only one way that can possibly actually happen. It's what separates the United States Revolution for Freedom and Independence from the bloody French Revolution, whose symbol seems to have been the guillotine. And it boils down to, who do you serve? And the same question can be stated differently. Where do the rights we have come from? Answer, the God of the Bible and nowhere else. And if we forget that, well, take a look around and see where it leads. A prudent man, said King Solomon, sees danger coming and takes precautions. And that seems like especially good advice nowadays.